Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. George Lakoff is one of the world's best-known linguists. He's widely recognized for his research on metaphorical thought, the embodied mind, and the structure of language. He is the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at UC Berkeley. With colleagues at Berkeley, Professor Lakoff founded the Rockridge Institute, a new political think tank dedicated to reframing political thought and political debate in this country. God knows we need that. He is the author of several influential books, Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think, and the New York Times bestseller, Don't Think of an Elephant. In addition to books on cognitive science, linguistics, philosophy, mathematics, and poetics. Professor Lakoff knows that you can't understand 21st century politics with an 18th century brain. How knowledge about the brain and the mind can help enact political change is the subject of his new book, The Political Mind, which he'll discuss tonight with veteran journalist Ian Masters. Very delighted to have Ian Masters here to interview Professor Lakoff. He's an important voice in our community and beyond. He's covered national security affairs for over 25 years on public radio. He's the host of Background Briefing and live from the Left Coast on KPFK, 90.7 FM on Sundays, and the host and moderator of the Hammer Forum and at the UCLA Hammer Museum. He's been a senior fellow at UCLA's Center for Strategic and International Affairs. He's edited and produced several documentaries. It's a pleasure to have him here. Please welcome George Lakoff and Ian Masters.
That's George Lakoff.
Hi, guys.
So, George.
I got it.
By the way, welcome to you all to this perfect place to discuss words and how they affect our minds and shape our lives, the Los Angeles Public Library. So, just to begin with, which are the more persuasive arrangements of political words that frame the most persistent and passionate debate in American politics? Pro-life or pro-choice? Obviously, if you're pro-life, you're for everything that's good. If you're pro-death, you're dead. And if you're pro-choice, it's, you know, should I get another handbag in the blue or the red? You seem, you know, capricious. What are the two great political struggles citizens are and will be engaged in for the next few years that are crucial to the future of our bodies and the freedom of our minds? If I were to tell you what my side of these two titanic struggles have as their battle cries, you tell me whether we're going to win. Huge issue number one, single payer. Huge issue number two, net neutrality. Obviously, single payer is dead on arrival in an insurance-based healthcare system that should be called a sickness profit system. And net neutrality is hardly adequate to describe how the telco and the cable monopolies want to take over the information highway, put up toll booths, slow lane all of your information and fast track everything they want to impose on you. So having made my point...
Well done, Ian.
This is the man who actually does this work, George Lakoff. And George, I was struck by just a sort of get you out of the gate running here. In your preface to this new edition, which you've written, a new preface to The Political Mind, which you can sign after this in the, I don't know, where's the signing? But somewhere near here. And I have twin goals in this book: to inform the reader about advances in our scientific understanding of human reason, and to show how such scientific knowledge can help us make sense of our politics. I hope that this edition can serve as a tool in the effort to reclaim these values, which are intrinsically American: empathy, nurturance, fairness, and equality, and return them to the center of our discussion of our country's future and all of our roles in making that future the best for all our citizens. So, George, how are you doing?
I'm keeping busy. I'm fine. Look, the reason for this book was that I'd written some other books on politics, and there in the other books I left the science out. I mean, I'm a cognitive scientist. That's what I do. I do linguistics and cognitive science and work with neuroscientists. And we work on a neural theory of language and thought. And we've actually learned a lot about how that works. And what I've done in previous books is just apply it to politics without telling you anything about the science. Here, it was time to actually put some of the science down. And it's science that most people don't know and aren't aware of. We all grew up with a certain view of reason and of the mind that I grew up with. For example, we assumed that thought is conscious. Turns out it's 98% unconscious. We assumed that reason could fit the world by itself, that you reason about the world in itself directly. Turns out you can't. The reason why? You think with your brain. Oddly enough, you have no choice. You think with your brain. Now, what does that mean? Turns out the brain was structured to run a body. And you can only think with a brain that is structured to run a body. And you can only understand things that that brain can understand through your body. It turns out that that is not just anything at all. It is highly structured. And we've been studying what those structures are. They're called frames and metaphors and cultural narratives. And we can talk about their details. But they determine how we understand everything, including our politics. So that's part of it. We also grew up thinking that reason was dispassionate, that passion got in the way of reason. Well, we have in Los Angeles Tony and Hannah Damasio, who discovered some years back that that the opposite is true, that you must have emotions and use them to reason. Why? It's really simple. Think for a minute, if you had a stroke and could not feel any emotions or tell what anyone else felt, how would you know what to want? Like and not like would mean nothing. You couldn't tell if other people would like you or not like you. How could you make a decision? It turns out folks who have those strokes can't make those decisions. It turns out you must be emotional to reason. Absolutely crucial. Turns out reason does not just use logic. It uses the logic of frames and metaphors and narratives. So we have to take that into account. Furthermore, the traditional view of reason says that reason is there in order to serve your self-interest, your purposes. Okay? Turns out reason is there for a lot more. In 1996, there was a remarkable discovery made in Parma, Italy, in the neuroscience lab. What they discovered was macaque monkeys could not only, if you looked at their brains, at the parts of their brains coordinated complex movements in the prefrontal, premotor cortex, it turns out that the same neurons fire when they perform an action as when they see someone else performing the same action. Pretty wild. This isn't magic. There are connections, physical connections, between that part of the brain and the parietal cortex just behind it, which integrates perception. And so it's not at all strange, but it turns out that those neurons are connected to other parts of the brain that have to do with emotions and judgment. And the result is you can look at someone else and feel their pain, if they're suffering great pain. You can look at someone who's experiencing joy and feel their joy. We have a physical basis for empathy. A physical basis for empathy. Now, that has great political ramifications, and here's why. Empathy is the basis of progressive thought. Every progressive idea is based on the idea that we care about. Progressives care about other people, and therefore they have to act on that care, which means they have to be responsible not just for themselves but others, hence social responsibility. And they have a commitment to make things better, to make the world better and make themselves better, their communities better. Now, those ideas are also the ideas behind Barack Obama's moral principles. If you actually read his speeches, he's very clear about this. In fact, the clearest speech is his Father's Day speech last year, 2008, where he goes through this for parents and then says the same is true of the government. Now, but it's very clear in the speeches. He also claims, and I think he's correct, that this is the basis of democracy. And the argument is very simple. It says, why should we bother having principles like freedom and fairness for everybody, not just the wealthy and the powerful, but for everybody? The answer is because we care about our countrymen. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. Why would we have freedom and fairness? Right? This idea that empathy is behind our democracy is crucial. And again, somebody in Los Angeles is crucial in understanding this. Lynn Hunt at UCLA, a historian, has a book called Inventing Human Rights, where she takes a look at the Declaration of Independence, where it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, and so on. And she asks, when did they become self-evident? Did they become self-evident, you know, with Descartes and reason? 1650, she's an expert on France, England, and America. Nope. How about 1675? Nope. 1700? Nope. 1725? Nope. Around 1750, you start getting novels, plays, paintings, drawings of people who are poor and oppressed by those who are more powerful than they are. And you get empathy welling up overwhelmingly, so that by 1776, it has become self-evident. Right? That's the basis of our democracy. It's empathy, responsibility for yourself and others, and making the world better. And what does that mean for a form of government? It means you have two moral missions, protection and empowerment for everybody. Protection is not just, you know, military or police protection, but environmental protection, worker protection, consumer protection, safety nets, healthcare, and so on. What is empowerment? Empowerment is what is necessary for anybody to earn a living at all in this country or in any country. It's exactly what's in the stimulus plan. It's public roads and buildings and schools and an education system. It's an energy system, a communication system. It's a banking system that works. It's a stock market that works. It's a judicial system that works. Without those things, nobody earns a dime in this country or any other country. The difference between living in America and living in a place that doesn't have it, say, Congo or Bangladesh or whatever third world countries that don't have protection and empowerment by the government, that is a huge difference. That's what taxes are about. Taxes are what you pay to have protection and empowerment by the government for everybody. And that's what it means to live in a civilized country. And this is something that you don't hear discussed very much. You don't hear Democratic politicians coming out and saying this out loud. Anytime anybody tells you they're against taxes, try explaining this to them. It's direct, and it doesn't take long. It takes about a minute.
Well, but the con about taxes is that the wealthy have convinced all these working class and middle class Americans that they're overtaxed, when in fact Reagan actually introduced the most regressive tax of all, which is the payroll tax, at the same time giving the wealthy huge giveaways, which have continued. So, I mean, aren't we talking about a con here?
Well, not only is there a con, but there's an interesting linguistic con. We don't have a problem of a tax problem. We have a wage problem. You know, wages, real wages for the middle class have not gone up seriously in 30 years. That is a wage problem. No one discusses the wage problem, but it's huge. You know, there are things, the thing about framing, let me tell you about what I mean when I talk about framing. Framing has to do with thought. Every thought you have and every word you have uses a certain kind of conceptual structure. And let me give you a simple history of it. The idea came about through three great people in the mid-1970s. Irving Goffman, sociologist, studied institutions. And he didn't just study institutions by sitting in an armchair like this. He went out and worked in them. He studied an insane asylum. He worked in an insane asylum. He studied Las Vegas. He worked as a croupier for a year. Now, he came to the idea after a while that all institutions have a structure called a frame. And that means that there are roles played by people in the institution. You take a hospital, there are roles. There are doctors and patients and nurses and, you know, receptionists and orderlies and so on, and certain places, operating rooms and reception desks and instruments like scalpels. These are, you know, that's what it means to have a hospital. You have those things. And then there are things that go on. You know, surgeons perform operations on patients with scalpels and lots of other things. And then certain things don't happen. What doesn't happen in a hospital? You walk into the hospital with your flowers to visit somebody and go to the reception desk. There's a doctor lying there. They give you a scalpel saying you're operating on the doctor. Something's wrong. Right? This is not supposed to happen. And you know what's not in the frame. Turns out every word like operation, operating room, surgeon is defined relative to such a frame. That was discovered by Charles Fillmore, one of my colleagues at Berkeley back in the mid-70s. Every word and every thought you have defined by that word is structured in terms of frames and conceptual metaphors and so on. Now, those things are crucial, and our politics is structured the same way. And that's what Ian was getting at the very beginning. When you choose a word, the frame comes with the word. And it's not arbitrary. You'd say tax relief. What does that mean? Relief says there's some horrible affliction that has taken place that you need relief from. And the person who relieves you is a hero. And if somebody tries to stop them, they're a villain. This says taxation is an affliction, and the guy who's getting rid of it is a hero. And if they say, no, we're not going to let you do it, that's a villain. You say tax relief, all of that structure is unconsciously activated. And if you say it over and over and over again, it keeps being activated until people unconsciously have that structure in their brains. That is what it means to use this language. And you hear it today, not just about taxes in this state. We can talk about the state in a while. But you hear it about, government takeover of healthcare, right? You hear all sorts of things of that sort over and over and over. And you get it in your brain.
Well, you've reminded me of another con, which is the death tax. This is a political movement funded by the Mars family and the Walton family, the owners of Walmart, and they've managed to, again, con people into believing that family farms are being confiscated by the government when none of that is true.
That's right, and the person who made it popular is Frank Luntz, who is their language person. He is a professional at naming things and naming giving arguments, of this sort. So this is crucial, you know, and what he said about the healthcare is you've got to convince people that the government is going to take away their choice of doctors and that they're going to, that they're going to take over medicine and get rid of your healthcare, right? That's what he put out, a document saying this, and then everybody follows the document. Okay, this is happening around the country. Now, one of the things that's really important to understand in all this has to do with communication systems. The conservative right in this country has set up a remarkable, remarkable communication system that has not been duplicated by the Democrats at all. What they did was they set up a system of think tanks starting in 1971 to get out these ideas, and they've hired language people to get out the right language. But then they set up training institutes to train tens of thousands of conservatives in how to speak and think like a conservative and how to argue like a conservative. Then they got folks who would volunteer around the country to be experts on certain issues, and they've got a list of those, and a booking agency that books them on radio and TV around the country every day on every issue. So if you want to see how that works, just turn on. You'll hear the same things being said over and over, and then it goes on The Daily Show.
Right? Which makes up for it all. Right.
Yeah.
But George, when you say empathy, and if the political dichotomy is over between those who are empathetic and those who are not, I'm reminded of this American expression that nice guys finish last. So I'm a little scared of that. I mean, I thought this political duopoly we had was essentially a minority party that depends upon Democratic votes to get into office, that doesn't believe in data and facts, so that it's very hard to argue with them. And on the other side, the Democrats have a natural majority, but they fail to inspire their people, their majority to show up. They did. They inspired them last time, and that the problem with progressives and liberals is that they would rather be righteous than effective.
Well, there's a problem with it. First of all, it's possible to be both, as you saw in the Obama campaign. The guys in the Obama campaign got the framing right most, 99% of the time. They really were very, very good. But Congress is different, and the administration is different, and so on, very, very different. And so you don't have a system out there like they had in the campaign. You know, Obama himself did a beautiful job this morning in his press conference, but he's not out there every day in every district, in every radio station, and so on. The conservatives are. And the people in Congress are not as good. That's just how it is. They don't have a system for doing it. Now, there is a question of what does it mean to frame things? There's a mistake about this that's very deep. The mistake has to do with the old theory of reason, that it's conscious, it's logical, everybody has the same reason, and so on, that it fits the world directly. So if you just tell people the truth, they'll reason to the right conclusion, that language doesn't matter, it just fits the world. Utterly false. If you want to get truths out there, you have to frame things correctly. You have to get the right conceptual structure in the brains of the people you're talking to in order for them to understand it at all. Because if the words don't fit the frame, they'll be ignored. They won't make any sense. You know?
Well, the political mind here, again, a cognitive scientist's guide to your brain and its politics, you spend quite a bit of time talking about the 18th century Enlightenment and the extent to which progressives think that when you finally conceptualize the right argument and present it, magically the world changes.
Exactly.
And it's like the Gospel of St. John, the truth shall set ye free, but invariably it does absolutely nothing.
That's right. And this is something that Ronald Reagan figured out. I had the opportunity to speak to Reagan's chief strategist, Richard Werthlin, some years ago. And I asked Werthlin, who was retired and very proud of what he had accomplished, what it was like to be Reagan's strategist. He said, well, I did my first poll for Reagan. Turned out nobody liked Reagan's positions on issues, and everybody wanted to vote for Reagan. And I said, I didn't understand this. Here I was chief strategist. I had no idea why anyone wanted to vote for my candidate. So he did more studies, focus groups, interviews. And what he found was that Reagan did five things right. One, he spoke about his values, not issues, not programs. Secondly, he connected with people, and communicated clearly. Third, he convinced people that he was authentic, that he said exactly what he believed. And then, if that's the case, if someone states their values, communicates clearly, says what they believe, then you can trust them. You may not agree with them, but you know where they stand, and you can identify with them. And that's what Reagan did. That's how he won. That's what the campaigns are about. They weren't about lists of issues. And what you have in with Democratic candidates traditionally have been lists of issues. In the last campaign, Obama transcended that. Hillary Clinton did not. Hillary came out with her lists of issues. Obama ran on those five things, and he won. And that's crucial. But then you get in Congress, and people come out again with the lists of issues. You know, what is our health care plan? It has this, 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 and this, right? Look, health care is about you and your doctor. It's about doctor-patient care. The question is, do you and your doctor determine your care? That's what the so-called public option is about. That's what, quote, single payer is about. And there's another very important thing. People are fed up with HMOs denying people care. They have an administrative system, 15 to 30% of the cost, is figuring out how to give you the least care possible and the cheapest care possible so they make the most money, right? And Obama actually said that today in his press conference. He talked about HMOs denying people care, and I'll bet you anything the press does not report that tomorrow.
Hey? Why would you? Why? I have my own ideas, but why?
Why? Because it goes against their whole view of what is an issue. The Democrats have not made the denial of care an issue. The issue, they'll say, they kept asking him, is the, quote, public option, you know, necessary for your position? You know, is that where you draw the line? You know, the press has an issue, a set of issues. You know, here it is. How strong is your language toward Iran? You know, should you use, which words should you use? And that's, they kept asking, one after another after another. You know, the major issue in healthcare is the private system isn't working. It's failing, right? It doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Two of the major reasons have to do with they're profiting from illness. A lot of the money goes to profit. And not only that, the administrative costs, which are very, very high. Medicare is only 3%. They have like 15 to 30%. You know, the administrative costs are set up to cherry pick to get the, you know, as healthy people as possible so they don't have to pay, and to deny people care or delay care as long as possible. You know, has any of you in the audience experienced any of that? Right? I mean, you laugh. That's why. You've all experienced this, right? The American people have, but the pollsters ask the wrong questions. They ask people, are you satisfied with your health care? They don't ask people if they've experienced delays in their care, denial of care. If they asked that question, they would get, 70 or 80% of people saying, yeah, right? That would become an issue. But the Democrats don't make it an issue. They need to make it an issue. Instead, they're arguing about, this provision, that provision, should it be a mandate, should it not be a mandate? And then they have the term public option. How do you guys like public option? Right? Exactly. What is it? Right? First of all, public immediately allows the conservatives to attack the government. Right? Option, you're not sure. Right? Look, this is doctor-patient care. You and your doctor determine your care, period. Yeah, straightforward. They don't say it. And this is a major problem. If you believe in the old view of reason and you believe that words just fit the world directly, and it doesn't matter which words you use, you say, oh, it's public and it's an option, everybody should just reason to the right conclusion. False. Right? They have dead ears.
Well, now that the age of enlightenment is over, and I think George Bush proved that, a lot of your book, George, is about how you, and I remember at the time tearing my hair out for years, about how was it that Bush's war and Bush's mistake became the Democrats' problem, and how continually they fell into this trap, And he even declared victory early with mission accomplished. And then shortly thereafter told us, well, we can't afford to lose the war. I already said we won. And still, they faithfully fell into his traps and his sucker punches. You couldn't cut funding, which was he challenged them to do, because you would leave the troops high and dry. This went on for years, this agony. And eventually it took you to get Jim Webb, who did the president's rebuttal in the 2007 State of the Union, to change this whole vector away from Iraq war to Iraq occupation. And then slowly the American people started to catch on about what was at stake.
Well, it was interesting because Jim Webb was one of the very few politicians who used the word occupation. After all, if you think about it, the war was over in a few months. Mission accomplished, victory, right? And what is a war? A war is one army against another army, right? That wasn't what happened after that. After that, you got resistance to an occupation. And nobody wanted to say that American troops were occupiers. I tried talking to folks in Congress about this, and one of the principal leaders of the Democratic Party, I won't give names, said in response, we can't use the word occupy or occupier. Think about people in my district who have lost children in this war. We can't say their children died for an occupation. We have to say their children died for something heroic. Otherwise, they'll vote us out of office. Now, you know, maybe the reverse could be true. You know, maybe the question of raising the question, why did people die, is an important question to raise. You know, that didn't occur. It didn't occur because they're very much concerned about such reactions from their population. And it's not a trivial concern. I mean, they have that real concern. But I'm just mentioning this is true. When the question is, are you supporting the troops? You know, they're not afraid. They're afraid to say the best way to support the troops is to get them out of there. You know, and not to have that. But that is not something that sounds patriotic from a conservative perspective. Now remember that every Democratic district has conservative talk radio in that district. It has conservative spokesmen every day on going on talking in those districts and on TV. They all have Fox News, right? They're going to get this day after day, and there's nobody except for a very few people, you know. Rachel Maddow has 600,000 people in the country watching her. That's about it, you know. They're not getting the same communication system. Now, if you ask Democratic fundraisers and funders and very wealthy folks, why are you not funding a similar communication system? They'll say, we have all the ideas we need. All we have to do is tell people the truth and they'll reason to the right conclusion. Right? We don't want to do what the conservatives do. You know, God forbid. You know, God forbid you should tell people what you believe.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things about the way that conservatives have appropriated the flag and the Bible, which and how they've taken the patriotic high ground with in total usurpation. And I don't understand why it is in this culture that the conservatives are the manly men like John Wayne and Ronald Reagan, neither of whom, by the way, fought for this country, but are the embodiment of patriotic values. And that the liberals have been painted as wimps. And I guess in a way it takes somebody like a macho liberal like Senator Webb to turn that around. So are we dealing with some kind of cultural problem here or a linguistic and framing problem?
It's a cultural problem and a very deep one. Way back when the conservatives took over Congress in 1994. I read The Contract with America. I have a great deal of civic duty, and I, you know, want to read, find out what the other side is saying. And I got very confused. And what confused me was this. I couldn't understand why people who were pro-life were for the death penalty. It didn't make sense to me. I couldn't understand why those people were for the flat tax, and why the people for the flat tax, you know, were against environmental regulations, and why the people against environmental regulations were for owning guns, even machine guns. And I couldn't understand why the guys who were for owning the machine guns were for tort reform. I mean, I just didn't get it, you know? And this is really tough for me because that's my field. I study the mind. You know, I study categorization and so on. This was embarrassing. So I asked myself, well, okay, I have the opposite views. What, you know, where did my views come from? It got more embarrassing. I could not answer that question. But I did realize it was a cognitive science problem. So I treated it like that. I went and I did some research for a while. And finally, I got nowhere for about 6 months. Finally, I asked myself why the conservatives were talking about family values all the time and what those values were. And I realized one of my students had written a paper showing that there is a metaphor of the nation as a family. We have founding fathers. We send our sons and daughters to war. We don't want missiles in our backyard. We have homeland security and so on. Right? And once you see that, you can see that there's a question that arises. You know, what views of the family are there? So what I did was I took the conservative and progressive views, put them in the output of that metaphor, which is it's a technical thing. Metaphors can be written down in mathematical form. And you work backwards through the formalism, and out popped two views of the family: a strict father family and a nurturing parent family. You can kind of guess which is which. And the strict father family, it turns out, is exactly the family that James Dobson has been pushing. And it goes like this in the family model. It says you need a strict father because he's got to defend the family, and mommy can't do it. And this is assumed to be a gendered family, you know, a father and a mother. Okay, you need a strict father because there's competition in the world. He's got to support the family, and mommy can't do it. You need a strict father because kids are born bad. Why bad? I mean, well, they just want to do what feels good. Have you ever heard of feel-good liberalism? Right? They just want to do what feels good. They don't know right from wrong. They have to be taught right from wrong, and the good strict father knows right from wrong, and he has to be strict enough to teach it. Why? Because the only way to teach it is through punishment when the kids do wrong. And Dobson is clear. The punishment must be painful enough so that they'll want to avoid the punishment and do what's right. And only then can they become moral beings. But if they do, they'll become disciplined, internally disciplined, and can go out into the free market and become prosperous. Now, what happens if you're not prosperous? Well, you can't be disciplined. If you're not disciplined, you can't be moral, so you deserve your poverty. Right? You've heard this argument before. Right? That is one of the arguments. Now, the strict father is the authority in the family. Nobody in the family has authority over the strict father. So, for example, in reproduction, you know, the father should have, you know, if the daughter needs an abortion, the father should be the person who decides whether or not she's going to get it, or whether she should be punished for, you know, the sins that she has had. If the wife wants to have an abortion to delay childbirth, to have a career, the father should be the person who determines that, not the mother. Okay, very clear. And so you get legislation, you know, for parental notification, spousal notification, and so on in many, many states to fit this model of the family. That is, family values are at the root of this. Now, what does this have to do with economics? Have you ever heard the expression, let the market decide? Right? Who is the decider? Right? The decider is the authority, the strict father in this family, in any unit. What that says is that the market itself imposes fiscal discipline on people. If they're disciplined, they should be able to make a living. If not, they don't deserve to. Right? That's what the market is supposed to do, and the market is supposed to work by greed. That is, if everybody seeks their own self-interest, the self-interest of all should be, by the invisible hand, maximized. Right?
That's what Alan Greenspan said.
That's what Alan Greenspan said, and he said he couldn't imagine that this could fail.
Yeah.
Right? But it failed. It is not said over and over by the Democrats that this principle failed, that greed isn't good, that the market should not be the decider, right? That is what went wrong, right? But that is part of the strict father model applied to the market. You have it applied in conservative Christianity, where you have a strict father God, and as opposed to a nurturing God, and so on. So you have different views of the family that apply. In a nurturing parent family, the idea is to nurture your child, to have empathy, to have responsibility for yourself and your children, and to train them to have both empathy for others and responsibility for themselves and others. Okay, straightforward, nurturing parent family. Now, what's really interesting about the brain is that the brain allows you to have contradictory worldviews at the same time, but on different issues. So there are people who are conservative on some issues and progressive on others. They're what I would call biconceptuals. And, sorry. And so they're that way. The point is, there is no ideology of the moderate. What is called a moderate is somebody who has some views on one, some issues, some on others, and all kinds of possible mixtures. Now, this is important to understand Obama. What Obama tries to do is, as long as he can get away with it, and he can't always, rather than move to the right, he tries to find conservatives who have some progressive views and then work with them on those views. And in fact, in one of his press conferences about a month ago, he spent 5 minutes trying to explain this to the press, who didn't report on it. Now, but he did. He went, if you go back and look at his press conferences, you will find this long discussion of just this issue. Because they were saying, hasn't your bipartisanship failed? And he'll say, look, you know, there are plenty of conservatives who agree with me on these issues and these issues. I'll work with so-and-so. But the American people rejected that ideology. You don't expect me to move to it, right? Very straightforwardly said this, not reported, right?
Well, George, obviously this explains why 60%+ of the women of this country vote Democrat and 60%+ of the men vote Republican. When you brought up the business of trying to figure out the inconsistencies in Republican philosophy based on the contract, for America or on America, as some people say. One of the issues that the Democrats will not touch is gun control.
Mm-hmm.
They're just chicken about it. And it's out there and it resonates, and every week or so a bunch of people get massacred by some deranged individual who had absolutely no problem buying a machine gun. So how do you get rid of that problem? I come from a culture which is just as manly as Australia, as John Wayne and all that nonsense, very macho place. And if you have a problem, you're supposed to go out the back and kick the hell out of each other. But the last thing you're supposed to do is pull a gun or a knife. That is considered culturally the most cowardly thing that a manly man could do. So how come we can't turn this gun thing around and train, or, you know, not train, that's a terrible word, but censure children from the earliest days when they start playing cowboys and Indians to the notion that that's an act of cowardice to point a gun at somebody? Does that make sense?
Very much so. When have you heard Democrats use the word coward for people who use guns? I mean, it's just not used. And it's an interesting point. I mean, look, suppose you're a hunter. Do you need a machine gun to hunt an elk? You know, I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, there's something, you need a Saturday night special to hunt an elk? I'm not going to help you much, right? This is absurd. We know this is absurd. We know that all of this is there. But there is an organization, a National Rifle Organization, that goes out and, again, using the right-wing message machine, says it over and over again, they're going to take our guns away, they're going to take our guns away, et cetera. You know, and this, nobody says that, you're a coward if you're shooting people.
Again, we get back to the idea that we need a left-wing message machine.
Well, I wouldn't say I wouldn't call it that exactly. What you need is a communication system through which progressives can say what they believe and repeat it over and over in whatever words they want. You need people in every community, namely you, in every community out there volunteering to speak out, whether it's at city council meetings or on the local radio or writing letters to the newspaper or having, local meetings, to speak out on these issues day after day with some organization. Now, the Obama campaign had an incredible organization. I spent some time listening to how they organized. And they got every Democratic voter in the country profiled. They got them in a GPS system, so that the people who went out to knock on doors knew everything about every door they knocked on, right? They know everybody. Why are they not? And they're trying to use this system to get out people to speak out on these issues, but they're speaking to their own people. They're not speaking to people in the conservative districts. Now, this is awful in California. We have this ridiculous two-thirds rule, which you know about, which is why there's no why we have the tremendous financial problems we have. It takes a two-thirds vote to raise any taxes at all, and a two-thirds vote in the legislature to pass a budget. What that means is that one-third plus one of either house can rule. They can hold everybody else hostage, which is why this budget disaster has happened, right? Now, I've proposed a very simple proposition for the 2010 election, and that proposition would read, it's nine words. It says, all legislative actions shall be determined by majority vote, period. Okay? I cannot get any Democratic leaders to go for this.
You need a majority to pass that, or two-thirds?
Here you have two wonderful people, Karen Bass and Daryl Steinberg, who won't push this. They had pollsters asking the wrong questions. And they had pollsters out there, and they said, the pollsters asked, do you want your taxes raised? Guess what people said? Okay? No, they said, well, we can't try to get rid of the two-thirds for taxes because people will worry about their taxes being raised. They're against that. They might be in favor of democracy. Right? If this is a democracy issue, with nine words, that could work. If they talk about it that way, if they get out there every day talking about what's wrong with this thing. They say, maybe majority is too much to push for. Maybe we should go a little at a time, like 55%. 55%. When you were in grammar school and you voted for the head of the class, was it 50% or 55%? It's majority everywhere. Everybody knows that. That's what democracy is about. It's not 55%. That doesn't mean anything to anybody, right? Right? They have their pollsters asking the wrong questions, and then instead of saying we have to change public opinion, they try to follow it. Right? That's the disaster of polling. Right? Let me give you an example. I talked to one of the major pollsters in this state who was doing polling for the legislature about the May 19th election. And you may recall that the Democratic leadership wanted all those propositions to pass in the May 19th election for reasons we can talk about in a minute. And I had been called in, this, you may not know this, when those propositions were put on the ballot, they were put on the ballot by Republicans in order to for them to agree to any budget deal at all. So the Democratic leadership felt they had to go along with them because they made the deal. You know, they said, okay, we'll do it if you vote for this, all right? So they put these crazy things on the ballot. But normally, when you have a constitutional change put on the ballot, the Attorney General's office is supposed to write up a neutral description of what's there. Well, they didn't want Jerry Brown doing that. So they decided they would write it themselves. And it was really outrageous lies on every one of them. So I was called in by some folks who took this to court to write a linguistic analysis of each of these things, which I did. And I got the court to change half of them. They didn't quite get all of them. They made a compromise. They got rid of half of them. But they kept the craziest one. The craziest one was the rainy day fund. Remember the rainy day fund? Now, if you have a rainy day fund in your house, right, and you have hardly any money and your children are starving, do you put the food money in the rainy day fund? That's ridiculous. That's what these guys wanted to do. They have terrible disasters happening in their state. And they want to take the top 25% every year and put it in the rainy day fund and then have that rainy day fund defined so that, you know, you couldn't get any more money than they had in the previous 10 years, ever, right? That's called a rainy day fund. That's ridiculous. So I talked to the pollster about it, who had done a poll asking people if they liked the idea of a rainy day fund. And people said, oh, the rainy day fund sounds pretty good, right? And I said, look, this is a lie. Here's why it's a lie. He said, no, it's completely objective. That's what it says right on the thing, rainy day fund. Right? He couldn't get the idea that what was on the ballot was a lie. You know, and this is not a dumb person. This is a really smart, incredibly smart top pollster in this state. Right? We have a problem that is partly linguistic, and partly has to do with people not understanding how you tell the truth to people, how you get people to understand what is really facing this state. And the other thing that our legislators are not doing, which they could do, they need 4 more Republican votes. 4. Right? Now, there are strong Republican districts and weaker Republican districts. They could perfectly well get unions, PTAs, teachers, etc., to organize in 4 or 5 or 6 of those districts and to have regular meetings over and over again to get their messages out in those districts to put pressure on those people. They didn't. You know, I could suggest it over and over again. Other people could suggest it. What they were doing was this. They were doing what they saw as being responsible. Responsibility for our leadership means when the governor calls a meeting, you go to the meeting and you listen to what you make your proposals, the Republicans reject them, and then you fight for every nickel that the Republicans are going to take out. And you try to make it as least bad as possible. Now, they have a majority in the state, 4 votes short of 2/3. And they're not appealing to the people of the state in any way, right?
And the Constitutional Convention would be a catastrophe because it undoes everything, and every issue out there would be thrown into the pot. Well, maybe this fear of a Constitutional Convention may get these guys to show some cojones, but...
Well, what's interesting about that is that it won't happen. If you look at what is required to have a Constitutional Convention, it's not going to happen. But I think it's important to discuss a Constitutional Convention, because the discussion should happen. The discussion of why you need it should happen.
Sure. I think we should open this conversation up here, because I know this is a public library and the public is being anxious to talk here. So here's the microphone. This gentleman here in front of you. Yes.
Hi.
Hello. We have been touching on this peripherally, and I guess I want to put it forward bluntly. Why is it that the conservatives have the fire in the belly and the progressives, the Democrats, don't?
Many progressives do. A lot of progressives do. The problem is that there are several problems. If you believe in Enlightenment reason, that you just tell people the facts, they'll reason to the right conclusion, that it's all a matter of logic, then you believe that the appropriate place to put that fire in the belly is in policy. And so you have policy think tanks. You don't have idea think tanks. In fact, ideas are seen as policies. They're not seen as ideas, as thoughts. And they don't ask, there isn't a policy for getting their ideas and beliefs out in public. Right? There is no such thing. The main policy think tank in the country is the Center for American Progress. They spend plenty of money on communications. They have a big communication set up. Nobody there is framing issues. There's not one person in that huge thing set up for this.
I get all the useless email all the time. This lady here, in the second in the row.
So much of politics seems to be based on arguments of slippery slopes, creeping socialism, protecting our gun rights. Can you speak to slippery slope arguments in the political dialogue?
Thank you. That's a very, very good question. Slippery slope arguments are all depends on the frame. Because what is it a slope towards? Right? Right? So when you frame this in terms of government takeover, it's a slippery slope toward that. If you frame it in terms of all our guns will be taken away, it's a slippery slope towards that. A slope has a direction. It points towards something and toward an end point. And, you know, if you feel with a slope there's gravity, that is, it is inevitable that things will fall down that slope, that says that the end point, the most extreme point, is what people will be afraid of. So it's the framing of the endpoint of that slope that has to be addressed, right? Now, the question is, how do you frame each of these issues? Are you going to have a violence-free society? Are you going to have a society where people are responsible about owning guns, for example? Where you don't allow people who are felons or, to have guns, and you don't have the kind of guns that only cowards use, right? You know, and notice that we have more than a slippery slope. We have a situation where we have guns that only cowards use, right? It is that understanding that is important. Coward is a strong word. Guns that only cowards use is a strong image. Right? And it's easy. It takes 10 seconds to tell what they are. Right? Anybody can do it very quickly and imagine it being repeated over and over again, millions of times every day. That's what you need. You need people doing that. Now, there's something, another thing very important about this. People think that our political leaders should lead. And that can't be true in terms of the framing of issues. They need cover. When they say something, it has to be something the public has heard before, over and over, so that it just makes sense and seems natural. And that's why you need people out there who are not necessarily in government speaking out on issues all the time in a serious communication system.
Yep. The gentleman here with his hand up in the blue T-shirt. Wait, there we go.
I need a little help understanding the cognitive functions that you're studying. One would assume that a normal, healthy brain would work the same way whether you are grown up here or in Zimbabwe. But your examples about empathy, except maybe very limited to kinship groups, doesn't seem to be true anywhere in the world. And what you grew up in this country, I grew up in this country, you have a political leaning, I may have a different one or the same. How do we get, if neurons are firing in a certain way and the brain is working in a certain way, how do we absorb this and come out with such different ideas.
Thank you for asking. I'll give an answer. It'll take a couple of minutes. I'll try to keep it short. First, we have a physical basis for empathy, which has to do with that we are born with. And we're all born with that physical basis, which is mirror neurons connected to the right circuitry that links them to judgment and to the emotional system. Now, that enables you to feel someone else's pain. But if you are raised in a situation where you don't experience a lot of empathy, or where you are abused, or where you are in a subculture where empathy is not seen as a good thing, those, if you don't use it, you lose it. That is, one of the things about brains is that when circuits fire, they get stronger. If they don't fire, they get weaker, right? That happens, and it's a tragedy, but it really does happen. Between the ages of 0 and 5, half of your neural connections die. That's how your brain gets structured. The question is, which half? If that's part of the half, you're going to have problems. So it is the case that this happens. Empathy is the basis of social connection. It is the reason that people form groups, that they understand each other. It is the major basis for social connection and social life. And that happens around the world. You know, it's not the case that there's little empathy around the world. There's actually lots of it. There's also a question of whether you're raised to think of other people as enemies and subhumans. If you categorize people as enemies and subhumans, you're going to be raised not to have empathy for them. That is a disaster.
Over here, right here in front, we have somebody.
Thank you. Can you comment a bit on what happened with Prop 8 and that whole debacle, and then in a greater sense, our whole attitude towards gay rights?
Wow. One of the things that happened was money flowed into the state from Utah and various other places, but also the issue of the question of what the issue is was not really brought out very well. The issue, this is a civil rights issue. It's a question of freedom and freedom to marry. It's not a question of gay rights. It's a question of human rights and freedom. And it's a question of American values. Are you a patriot or not? Do you believe that we are all equal? Do you believe in fairness? Do you believe in freedom, including the freedom to marry? That's one part. There's a second part that was missing, which is they let the religious folks get away with the idea that marriage was about religion. Marriage is civil. People who are ministers get to be ministers by the state giving them the right to be ministers. And, of course, you can join a Universal Life Church for $15 and become a minister, right? Just go online, and it takes 10 minutes, and you can do that. But the point is that it's the state that permits religions to marry, that this is a state function. There's a further part. Religion is a social institution. Marriage itself is a social institution. So is religion. Marriage is social in its nature. It has to do with, whether you are recognized as a couple, what kind of social life you enter into. And then there are not just legal rights, but social forms of recognition. And people should be free to take part in those. Those arguments were never given. They're never given. People don't understand that this is not a matter of religion, that it is a matter of social rights and a social institution that is important for holding society together, and that this is an issue of freedom. Now, those things are crucial. There's a further part about definitions, the definition of marriage, right? If you look at, what marriage is, definitions are given culturally. If you look at the Bible, you know, you have very different forms of marriage in the Bible, right? You have concubines, you have all sorts of other ideas about marriage. You know, those are not being proposed. You know, the idea that, you know, there is a definition given in, you know, in the universe as to what marriage is ridiculous. It is defined by law. And the question, and law is made by people. And in this country, law is supposed to serve freedom and fairness. That's what it means to be a patriotic American. Nobody was waving the flag, you know, against Prop 8. They needed to be waving the flag against Prop 8.
Well, they did have a campaign. I did interview them, and I couldn't believe how inept they were. Their ads were completely amorphous, and they didn't deal with the fundamentals. One side's for hate, one side's for love, one side's for tolerance, one side's for bigotry. They treated marriage as a zero-sum game. There's only enough marriage to go around. If the gays get somebody will take it away from the straights.
Right.
The whole thing is preposterous.
They had an idiotic ad agency.
Right. But they also thought that that people would vote down ticket from Obama, and they would ride in on Obama, and they didn't factor in that minority voters weren't very tolerant in this regard, and clearly there has to be an education outreach.
They also didn't follow the idea that Obama came out against gay marriage in Audacity of Hope. Now, when I read that passage in Audacity of Hope, I don't know how many of you have read that passage, I virtually threw the book against the wall. You know, I like Obama a lot, but in this passage, it was very clear. He almost telegraphed it that this was a political position. Right? What he said was, you know, he started with a story, as usual with a story, that one of his supporters, who was a lesbian, came to him and asked him to support marriage. And this was somebody who had been in a long-term relationship, was raising children, was a great mother. He knew the person's partner, he knew the family, he knew the children. He thought there was a wonderful family, it was terrific. And he thought maybe he was wrong. But he said, I may be wrong, but I'm not yet ready to go there. Right? What does that tell you?
The lady in red up there in the back.
Going back to the frame of the government as family, and you mentioned the conservative view of the stern father figure, I'm wondering what you think the possibilities of changing that frame would be given current conditions, where, say, the Republicans would go from being the stern father to being the cranky old uncle no one takes seriously, he's always screaming about socialism and the like. And the Democrats go from being this weak mommy figure that isn't strong enough to stand up against terrorists or something to being the family members of both genders who come to the rescue of the kids, i.e. the citizens' illnesses, such as healthcare problems, the economy, et cetera. Can this frame be changed, or is it more something we're going to have to deal with for a long time?
You're going to have to deal with it for quite a while, and let me talk a bit about why. And this is something I didn't get into. There's a technical reason for this that I didn't get into. The way metaphors are formed in the brain is in the following way. And if you think about, by the time you're 4 or 5, you have learned hundreds of unconscious conceptual metaphors, like more is up and less is down, or something like affection is warmth. All right, why is affection warmth? You know, why a warm person, a cold person? Because when you're held as a child, you experience affection and warmth together, temperature. Why is, you know, more up? You pour more water in the glass, the level goes up every time. All right. What happens in a child's brain? In a child's brain, the child will see the water go up every time, may not pay attention, but the brain pays attention. Two parts of the brain will be active, one for quantity, one for verticality. Or it experiences affection and warmth together, you know, two parts of the brain will be active, the emotional parts and the temperature parts, in different places. What happens when that happens over and over? You get co-activation in the brain where this happens, lots of activation, and those things, the more they're active, the stronger they get. They then spread along existing pathways. Then that happens over and over, and they spread further and further until the shortest pathway is formed. And when that happens, that is reinforced from both sides, and you get a circuit formed. And that circuit is there for life. Okay? It is there. It is used. Now, so it's not just more is up and affection is warmth that is there before you've even learned language. Think about your family. Think about, you know, the idea is your first experience with governance is in your family. So the idea that a governing institution is a family is going to be formed naturally. Now think about the moral systems that have to do with that. You know, how do you get moral systems? By having parts of the brain that have to do with satisfaction versus dissatisfaction, that is two major emotional pathways, be active together with other things regularly. So, for example, if you eat pure food, you'll be satisfied. If you eat rotten food, you won't. Therefore, morality is purity and immorality is rottenness. You know, something's rotten in the state of Denmark. Why does this happen? This matters because you're going to learn that there are two of the many ways of understanding morality. One of them is that morality is nurturance. You're better off if you're taken care of. The other is you're better off if you're a baby and you listen to your parents, assuming they're trying to help you. Namely, that means morality is obedience. Those two things will be learned, and they're learned around the world, and they combine with the other metaphors for governing institutions of family. And so you're going to get these things arising over and over. I'm sad to say that they will arise. The question is, what counts as being masculine? And that is cultural. And the question is somebody like Obama masculine, who is gentle, who is relaxed, who is smart, and who cares about his family? Right? That is a possible way of being masculine. That's really important in this culture. And it's not just being masculine, it's a way of having authority. You have authority because you care about people and you act on that care. That is the idea of authority that needs to supplant the other idea of authority.
And I just wanted to add on that topic, that I'm absolutely mystified why in this country liberals are on the defensive. Because if you look at the history, it's very clear that liberals are the pragmatists who do the heavy lifting, and the conservatives are the dreamers who just say no. Women's rights, human rights, civil rights, stopping the Nazis, just recently saving the economy, once in 33, and now perhaps we don't know whether it's going to be saved. They do the heavy lifting. The other side says just say no. So I don't get it. Why are liberals defensive? The lady next to her, yes. Yes, you.
Thank you. My question was regarding the press. If you can maybe speak upon that a little bit.
Yes.
Why would a seemingly free press in the United States have so much trouble conveying the truth in, I guess, a truthful way?
It has to do with the way they're taught in schools of journalism. And this is extremely serious, including my own, the Berkeley School of Journalism, an excellent school. I sometimes am asked to talk to the first-year entering class in the graduate school. And I have the following experience whenever this happens. I'll tell them very much what I told you. And about 15 minutes in, someone will raise his hand and say, isn't that the opposite of what we're being taught? They're being taught enlightenment reason. Who, what, when, where. Just state the facts and everything will be fine, right? Use the words that are most common and most popular, even if they define right-wing values, because framing is not taught as part of journalism. The idea that the choice of words matters politically is not taught, and how it matters is not taught. So what you have are journalists who are taught a false theory of communication. We have a problem, especially in the context where the conservatives have such a strong communication system.
Well, you also have this ridiculous, idea of fairness and balance, which Fox have appropriated, where you have to do thesis, antithesis, synthesis. You have to present the pro-argument, then the con-argument, and then end up with a meaningless mush.
But it's worse than that. Because if you go on Fox, and you have two liberals and two conservatives, you have a conservative host who uses conservative framing. Are you for or against tax relief? Doesn't matter which it is. It's still that way. And this happens all the time. Yes.
The lady down here in the front row, the front row.
Do you think that with YouTube and the kind of technology we have on the internet, that it's kind of balancing out the Fox News and as far as framing? People can go on and look at a YouTube video and see what was said versus having someone tell them what they should.
Well, you don't just interpret the YouTube video free of your framing. And this is extremely important. First of all, the internet has created strong subcommunities. That is, there are progressive blogs and conservative blogs, more conservative blogs, right? That is, huge numbers of conservative bloggers out there, getting their message out through the blogs. And this is important to understand. It's not, if you're reading the liberal blogs, you might think that they're all liberal. They're not. So that's the first thing. YouTube is very important, especially with what's happening in Iran these days. Incredibly important. But the question is how you interpret it. So, and you could see it in the president's press conference today and also on CNN last night. We turned on CNN and there was Wolf Blitzer, who always frames things in a conservative way. And he had on Paul Wolfowitz as a guest, right? And Wolfowitz was seen as a neutral party. Yeah, and saying that, Obama is too weak, and citing the YouTube examples as examples of Obama's weakness in responding, right? Now, Obama did very, very well today, and if you go on YouTube, you'll see his press conference, and I think you should. He responded extremely well to those charges. But the point is, just seeing it doesn't tell you what you're seeing. Because what you're seeing depends on the frames you bring to what you see.
We'll make this the last question here, the gentleman down here on the far right. I'm not sure that he is, but...
Well, thank you. My name's Timothy Kreck. The most patriotic thing I ever did was something that went completely contradictory to my upbringing, which was as a very conservative youth from New York City. And that was, I went to Vietnam, and when I came back, I was so radicalized that I joined Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and I went to Washington, D.C., and I threw my medals on the steps of the Capitol. And thank you. I appreciate that, but not about me. My point is that I'm wondering what your hope is for men in the 21st century. 20 years I've worked with men, and you just spoke at some length about, reframing things, and I have to put a plug in for your book. I'm sorry. You added some great to-do lists and great questions at the beginning of part two. I really appreciate that. But my question is that if men are still stuck in their fear and the way to express themselves is as an expression of fear instead of nurturing, how are we going to move beyond that kind of neural programming?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of it in our popular culture. If you start looking at your TV programs and look at beer ads, and look at the ads for the Super Bowl and so on, what you see is old masculinity of the worst kind coming back. It is really gross in a lot of ways. And, that's happening in popular culture. And it happens through ad agencies selling products. And, the question is, well, they sell products that way because the products sell that way. But, in fact, it reinforces itself. People don't understand that advertisements are not neutral, that TV shows are not neutral, that they have a major social and political and economic effect. And that effect has to do with the understanding of what the market is and what it means to have greed and to sort of say, okay, I'm out for myself and that's good. One of the things that is not said, let's say, in the current environment is that our current ecological problems, our global warming, has the same cause as our economic problems, namely short-term greed, seen as good. The same cause. Nobody's saying it. Nobody's coming out and saying that is what's wrong. Now, it is crucial that people come out and point out that these are not separate categories or separate issues, and that they have everything to do with the concept of what counts as masculinity. Right? This is absolutely crucial, and it's not surprising. If Sam Huntington, who was the major professor at Harvard who taught the conservative leadership that came out of there, wrote his last book on masculinity, as the basis of what our moral system ought to be. I mean, this is a disaster. And it's not seen, and the same thing is happening in radical Islam. You get the same view of masculinity in an even stronger form, right? This is not a good idea. One of the nice things about Obama is he is showing by example how to be a man in a very different way.
Mm. Well, George, based upon the amount of advertising on television for Viagra, I think men have other problems. Let's all join in a round of applause for our wonderful guest tonight.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.